Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Fáilte rud thig an seo agus lá féile pórach sona díobh go léir. It's St. Patrick's Day. Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company for the next hour. And we've got some of the News Talk family here in studio with us to help me do just that as we take a look at some of the ways that you might busy yourself this St. Patrick's Day, whether that's from the comfort of your own sofa or whether you're out and about with the family. Well, joining me here in studio today, we have movie buff and presenter of Screen Time, John Fardy. He's here to talk about Irish movies that have made their mark at the box office, and Jess Kelly, presenter of Tech Talk. She's going to take us through the official biggest selling singles and Irish acts of the last 20 years. And last but not least, Eamon Torsney, news anchor at News Talk and fellow Nottingham Forest football supporter, is here to talk us through the biggest Irish visitor attractions. We're open on Twitter at StockNT for any of your St. Patrick's Day suggestions, so feel free to get involved. John, I'm going to kick off with you. St. Patrick's Day, what do you do with the family on St. Patrick's Day?
We don't go to the parade.
Do you not?
I just find parades miserable, to be honest. even the really good ones, there's just too much hanging around. And really, I'm sorry, but you're looking at stuff and if it was any other day, you'd be like, why are we looking at a dragon?
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm sorry.
I love the parade.
Do you?
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a parade?
I've never been in one now. I'd be quite a spectacle if I was, but the Dublin one's pretty impressive now, I have to say. And I think it's grown over the years, obviously, compared to what we might have seen in when we were younger. Yes. And they were slightly drab. But I think the Dublin parade is great. And even watching people going in, you know,
at the
bus stops all dressed up as, you know, St. Patrick and leprechauns, all the atmosphere is terrific.
I sound like the Scrooge version.
You do. What about you, Jess? What do you do?
So, I'll be honest, I'm a bit more on John's side than I had to believe there a second ago. I kind of hate Paddy's Day now, but back in the day, I used to love it.
I know.
My favourite thing, and the clearest memory I have, is my mum pulling me and my three siblings and our jumpers to put the, like,
the shamrock, is it?
Shamrock, yeah. On our jumpers, and the jumpers would be sagging down because you've got so much shamrock on you. And then we'd go into town and we'd all take turns sitting on Dad's shoulders trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know what? You asked him, was he in the parade? I was technically in the parade.
Go on.
Transition year. Now, because I'm an awkward soul, I didn't actually do any of the cool stuff. I went around and filmed it. But one of our TY projects was to build and do a dance and whatever. I'm not a dancer. But I walked the parade. I was like on the little thingamajig as I walked through. So some of my classmates were in the parade.
Very good. The Dublin one, the main Dublin one?
Oh, yeah.
That's impressive.
Well, I can imagine all of you on a little float or behind Pat the Baker. I was in the St. Patrick's Day parade once by accident. So I was driving from Dublin down to Longford with a friend of mine, and we got the timings all wrong, and it was you didn't have a motorway or anything at the time, so we literally every little town we hit, Leixlip, Mullingar, we were actually ending up in the middle of the parades. But anyway, look, there you go. Look, let's kick off and see if we can look at some things that might entertain you this weekend. We're going to start off with you, John Fardy, looking at some of the Irish movies. Kind of when you look at the Irish movies, it's funny because if you look at what made it big in the box office, they're not necessarily things we'd watch off a St. Patrick's weekend.
No, the list of the top 10, you know, most lucrative or the ones that scored the biggest at the box office are not what you might expect. But that said, when you talk about modern Irish cinema, the movie in a way that began the golden age, I think, is My Left Foot. Now, people might start texting and going, but there was movies like Cathal Bloch's Korea, The Quiet Man.
Why do you think that one started it off, though?
Because it was the first time there was a full-blown indigenous Irish production. And like Jim Sheridan and Noel Pearson, you know, Van Morrison once said about U2, there was no Irish music business until U2. And in a way, I don't think there was an Irish film business until Jim Sheridan and My Left Foot actually came. Because before then, it felt a bit like Irish productions were threadbare and we were kind of hanging on by someone else. And in a way, My Left Foot is a linchpin. And there's a whole theory, which we don't have to get into now, but that's wound up in Italia 90. And a growing sense of proud Irishness began with things like My Left Foot. So even though it's not in the top 10 most successful Irish movies of all time, it is the one that gave rise to the Irish film industry as we know it now today, I would suggest. And it is a great movie. Mm. Now, you could say there are stage Irish elements to it in a way, in that it's, you know, it was the slums of Dublin, but that was the way, you know, Christy Brown was. That's where he grew up. And
of course, wonderful acting, Brenda Fricker and Daniel Day-Lewis, and like that kind of started him off on the world stage.
See, that was the other thing as well. This was the first time we saw two Oscars go to Irish people. Now, there was the whole thing, was he Irish, was he English? You just have to ask him. He feels very Irish and always has. But Brendan Fricker certainly was. So that was a huge part of what happened. And in a way, that led into the next great blooming of Irish cinema that I think for Paddy's Day, are you allowed to call it Paddy's Day? I think you are.
Oh, definitely, yes. Yeah.
But if you ask people to name a great Irish movie and one you might watch on St. Patrick's Day, The Commitments, right? And it's become a prisoner of its own success. But I remember going to see that in the cinema in like fourth year in school going, oh my God, like I grew up in Blanchardstown and Jess was in a slightly posher part of Dublin, but it even probably would have spoke to her.
I wasn't born at back, the time.
Well, let's not get into that. Okay. But Roddy Doyle and what happened with Alan Parker is another great moment in Irish cinema, because My Left Foot was brilliant and all, but for a lot of people, this was the first time we saw people who felt very Irish on the screen. There had been a movie back in the 70s called Quacks or Fortune Has a Cousin in the Bronx.
Missed that
one. With the great Gene Wilder. And it was Paddy Rackery to the hilt, and he was a dung collector. And people complained about those kind of movies. That wasn't inner city Dublin. But with things like The Commitments and later The Snapper, you had that. But neither of those were in the top 10 most lucrative Irish movies of all time.
And the great thing about The Commitments for me, when I saw it, I felt it was the first time we saw a representation of kind of modern Ireland, even though it was a bit rough around the edges and the shoulders. And I remember some people were whinging at the time, oh, you know, you can see a burnt out car in the background of a scene and this will be create a terrible image of the country. But I sat there thinking, well, finally we're getting to see an image of the country, but also the humour as well. Yeah. And it was great. And I actually remember seeing it twice, and I went to see it in Galway and in Limerick. So I was in cinemas surrounded by people from the country watching this Dublin film, slagging off Dubliners. And it was great to watch the reaction. Everybody enjoyed it.
But I think there's sometimes back in the day that we're a similar age and country people, for want of a better phrase.
Okay, where are we going with this one?
No, but their sense of Dublin and what it was like, or what people were like, had an awful lot to do with Roddy Doyle movies.
Yeah. What do you mean? What do you mean by that? That we didn't understand this sprawling metropolis.
They'd quote it to you endlessly and do a Commitments accent as they saw it, going, "Oh, you're a dub. You must talk like that kind of." That's my sense. So it was a huge life.
And yes, we haven't mentioned the music in The Commitments yet, but iconic, really.
Absolutely iconic, and I think that is a great film that I would say represents all the elements of what it is to be Irish, in terms of the bit of crack, music, like foul language. It just seems to encompass everything. And I think the songs from it still sound as good today as they did back in 91 when it came out. Your man's voice.
Andrew Strong.
His father was Rob Strong.
Just incredible. Yeah. Still kind of, you get the little tingles every time you hear it. And I absolutely love that movie. That's one of the most rewatchable movies in my opinion.
Absolutely. And it's one of those movies people always say, it's on the TV and you start it and then you just can't stop.
My husband actually was in Cambodia when this came out and they had it on a video. It was the only video they had. So unfortunately for me, he knows every single line of this movie. But yeah, what else, John, is on the list for you in terms of iconic Irish music?
Well, none of those, because this is a business show and I know you'd like
to mention the finances. We're all about the business this morning,
None of those movies are in the top 10. But John Carney, who gave us the great movie Once, right, which was, that was made on a shoestring with Glenn Hansard and Marquetta, and they went around town and bussed and it was beautiful, and that won an Oscar, and he famously said, make art at the Oscars. Like, what a great acceptance speech, you know. But anyway, but his movie that's actually in the top 10 is Begin Again, which I think is still on Netflix, which people didn't rave about, and there was some issue about John Carney wasn't wild about Anne Hathaway's performance, maybe, he said retrospectively.
What's Begin Again about?
It's a great movie where Anne Hathaway is kind of this struggling musician and Mark Ruffalo is the guy who's going to possibly guide her career, and he has his own problems going on, and it does that thing that John Carney movies do brilliantly. It has music in it, and his latest one, Flora and Son, some people found it a bit twee. I think it's kind of delightful, but again, there's music at the centre of it, and John Carney's a unique kind of voice in that way, in that he does music in movies the way no one else does. I don't know if you've seen Sing Street.
Oh, yeah. My favourite films of all time.
It's absolutely really glorious.
Great film.
And the Jack Rayner, the older brother music snob. Listen, man, you cannot be listening to Phil Collins when you're a teenager. It's just glorious stuff, you know. I've modelled myself on him, you know. And then, of course, we have to... Should I keep going? A few
more? Please do,
okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, just I'll wait for the pause.
Well, maybe one more before somebody else can come in.
Absolutely. Well, Neil Jordan, who, you know, is... again, one of those huge Irish filmmakers, is also in the top 10 for a movie that might surprise you. It's not Michael Collins, which is a great movie, but at number 7 of the most profitable Irish movies ever made is The Crying Game.
Wow, that was a surprise. But while we're on Neil Jordan and we're speaking about Michael Collins, I should ask you, have you ever been an extra, John, in any movie?
Oh, Mandy, it's funny you should bring that up because the year was 1995, I think it was. No, I was an extra in Michael Collins. It's a pretty underwhelming
I'm
story.
I'm surprised, though,
I'm in a crowd scene in Bray Wanderers. It's not like I said,
hi,
Michael.
That.
I'm sure I told you.
You've told everybody else.
I've told everyone everything.
And there's probably more impressive acting than Julia Roberts, in fairness.
Oh, cool.
Well, John, actually, you were interviewing Julia Roberts yourself on Screen Time a couple of weeks ago, and you didn't even bring up that accent with her.
No, but I did bring up Michael Collins, and I told her, I showed it to her, or I've watched it about 30 times because I used to show it to Italian students that I used to teach, and she said, very politely, that's 29 times more than I was.
Well, I'm amazed she didn't pluck you out of the crowd when you were an extra. Amy, can I bring you in here for a second? Do you have a favourite Irish movie of your own?
Favourite? Well, I would have gone for The Commitments, in fairness, because it's a go-to movie, and Michael Collins, because, again, I think that was the first, dare I say, post-Troubles movie that we could show in the Republic of Ireland.
That's a really good point.
Post-censorship, post-anywhere we could confidently show a historical movie from an Irish perspective without having to worry about what the meaning was to the international audience. And I think it shows how far we've come that I remember one evening, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and the BBC showed it just randomly some night, and I thought, wow, when I was growing up that wouldn't have happened, and it was an interesting time, and he's such a successful
and Liam Neeson and Alan Rickman as Dev was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Now there are historical inaccuracies in it, but Neil Jordan, I remember, and this isn't a name drop, but I remember asking him about it when I interviewed him, and he said the problem with Michael Collins is it's like making a public statue and everyone has a view on it. You put the hand here. So I still like, it's our genuine bona fide Irish epic. We don't tend to make epic movies, but that is an epic movie. And my own small contribution to it, I think, paid off.
The fact that the candidate you're being asked to vote for is at this moment rotting in an English jail shouldn't put you off. Sure wasn't I in one myself till a week ago. They can jail us. They can shoot us. They can even conscript us. They can use us as cannon fodder in the Somme. But we have a weapon more powerful than any in the whole arsenal of their British Empire. And that weapon is our refusal. Our refusal to bow to any order but our own.
Jess, do you have a favourite Irish movie? You mentioned Sing Street earlier. Is there something else?
Sing Street. Do you know what I love are the movies that are depicted on real life events. So things like Bloody Sunday, James Nesbitt is sensational in that film. And that, I remember seeing that with my big sister for the first time and being shook by that. Veronica Guerin, was an excellent representation of something that happened, and you get a real sense of what Ireland was like at that time. So I think movies like that show the truth of Ireland, not the Heidley Ho, Gosh and Begara version. I cannot stand those type of things. But I think even The General, we have so many brilliant stories that are told incredibly well, acted very well, and are a true reflection of elements of Irish society.
And what about, John, those diddly idle ones, Darby O'Gill and The Little People? How did they rank on your...
Well, you know what? I remember Jim Sheridan actually saying a thing. He was going to a screening of Darby O'Gill and The Little People in the IFI, and he was talking before, and he said, you know, we need to relax. It's no big deal. Every country has its stereotype. You don't see the British getting up in arms about four weddings and a funeral and it's all jolly ho-ho and they go home and spank each other or whatever. I don't want to get too deep, but maybe that's a post-colonial thing. It's not that big a deal. Every country has these things, and there's always going to be a little paddywhackery. This weekend there's a new movie called Irish Wish on Netflix, which has plenty of paddywhackery-isms in it as well.
But I think it's just nice that we have the spectrum of Irish life represented in cinema. So you can have the Heidley Ho and all the rest, and that's grand, but we also have these incredible stories that show the rich tapestry of our history and our personalities and our music. And
yeah,
our
we don't take it too seriously either. No. That's an important point. John, The Quiet Man, which is my favourite movie. I love the music in it. It's amazing. And it is in a lot of Steven Spielberg movies in the background.
Yeah, he loves it as a movie. Mm. And he loved Maureen O'Hara. I'm conscious we're near an ad break, but I have to quickly mention before we finish on Colleen Kewan. Nominated for an Oscar last year, unfortunately didn't win. But there's a new whole slew of Irish language movies that, you know, and no disrespect, but in the past it was like, this is worthy. It's kind of dull. But this new, like on Colleen Kewan, was one of the most beautiful movies ever made. Kneecap, which people are going to be talking about and is going to upset a lot of people in a few months' time, I've actually seen, is amazing. And the Irish is amazing in it. So there is a blooming time coming for Irish language movies, I think. And can I just quickly tell you then what the movie number one at the Irish box office is? And this is kind of strange. A Good Day to Die Hard. Why, might you ask? Because it's directed by John Moore. Mm. He's never mentioned. He's Dundalk born. He's one of the most successful directors working in the world today.
Well, look, in keeping with that Irish theme, thought to engage Dr. Newsock, Shoei Mandy Johnson, August Talk, Suez Thoreish, Antosa. We'll be looking at the most successful Irish visitor attractions, and that's coming up after the break. Walter Ashko, News Talk, Shoei Mandy Johnston, and I'm joined here in studio by John Fardy, Jess Kelly and Eamon Torsney, all of News Talk, and we're looking into things that might entertain you this bank holiday weekend. And we've got a decidedly Irish view, and we're going to start looking at some places that have proven very financially successful as tourist attractions. Eamon Torsney, news anchor here at News Talk, you've been looking at the stats around this to see what's hot and what's not.
Yeah, well, the top 10 visitor attractions, well, you know, the number one visitor attraction in the country is the Guinness Storehouse in Dublin. And it got me thinking, particularly because we're looking at the business aspect to it, but aren't they lucky as a private enterprise to have a product that's associated with the national identity? And that, I mean, how much is that worth to them? To be actually, there's a very few others. The only other ones I could think of were originally state companies like Aer Lingus, and, you know, but now, of course, they've gone private, etc. And so I think that's kind of significant. But also the fact that 1.1 million people visited there in their most recent figures. It's incredible. They've really recovered from the COVID pandemic as well. And in terms of how it impacts economically around the visitor centre itself, there was one report which suggested that the people, 34% people visit the venue. That was the role in their decision to visit Dublin, number one, which is kind of interesting.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
I was really taken aback by that, that would be the first thing you think of. And that it translates into an economic contribution of 361 million over a year, and tourism responsible for overseas earnings there of 6.6 billion and 225,000 jobs. But overseas visitors to the storehouse spend an average of 134 a day on other services and experiences, supporting 8,900 jobs. And so it shows that, you know, one attraction has such a ripple effect around the city and around the country indeed.
Yeah, and we can be quite precious about this ourselves. You know, when politicians or dignitaries come, they want to be photographed there with their pint. But we sometimes forget the spin-off for other tertiary industries and the fact that people are actually making decisions based on this.
Yeah, and then you have the contrived controversies that happen usually every time, you know, around Patrick's Day when some foreign leader picks up a pint of Guinness and goes and cheers us all, and then we all get really uptight and go, oh, we're all being depicted really badly abroad. And then you realise, well, actually, this is really important, you know.
What I love about Guinness, though, is that if you walk around where the Guinness Storehouse is, and you pay attention to just how much of the property in that area that they own, but also the regeneration that's gone on in that area in the last few while. Like, they've opened their new whiskey distillery in the last few years. They kind of did up one of the buildings that was just sitting there behind black railings. And that's now another tourist experience. I don't love the notion of the booze and Ireland side by side the entire time, but you have to take your hat off to it. It is an incredible thing. And every tourist that you see goes around with a storehouse bag. They buy the merch, they spend the money, they go off to find the best pint outside of the storehouse and all the rest. It's such clever business.
Yeah.
And John, I know you were anti St. Patrick's Day parades. Have you ever done the Guinness Storehouse tour?
Well, here's the thing. I mentioned in the first part of the show about teaching Italian students. So I spent a couple of summers doing that. So I was there a load of times on those tours. I love the view in it. But what Eamon says about, you know, we need to be clever about this financially and economically. Mm. So with those Italian students, an icebreaker always at the start was, tell me 10 things about Ireland. And before Bono, before the Blarney Stone, the first thing they ever said, and this was teenagers, was Guinness. Mm. Yeah. And like, we can jump up and down about it. And I get what Jess is saying. We don't want association, but it sells. And I think they were right to make such a tourist attraction. And the view at the top of that is amazing.
Yeah. And that's it. That is it. That gravity bar view is exceptional. And they've managed very well to kind of capture that and make an experience as well as just selling a product.
If you go on their website and you see the type of tours, I think the cheapest tour is something like €20, but that's just for the very basic tour. But then they have all sorts of other things, you know, where you get this, you know, a connoisseur tour as well. And then you get to actually pour the pint. And then I have some useless statistics as well that might be of interest to you as well. The Guinness Storehouse served over 1.2 million pints of Guinness in 1 year, along with 42,000 pints of Guinness Zero. So they're obviously even changing the market they're going for there as well. They certified 134,000 pint pouring experts. So that's that little gig you do when you're there as well. And then there were 7 proposals made in the Guinness Storehouse and they were all accepted. So imagine telling your kids and grandkids, you know,
this is where it all started.
In a brewery.
Yeah. You know? Well, look, Eamon, no statistic is ever wasted on this programme. So thank you for going into that. What else is on the list?
Well, on the list, second, so we go from the Guinness Storehouse to the Cliffs of Moher in County Clare.
Has everybody done this?
No. Oh, yeah. Oh,
really?
No, I haven't either.
Oh, sorry.
I'm a really bad tourist.
No, I haven't done it either. Yeah.
Oh. You've never been to the Cliffs of Moher?
No, I know.
Yeah. I've actually been to the top 10 Irish visitor attraction. I'm quite proud of myself.
Really?
I was quite proud, yeah. But the Cliffs of Moher was terrific. And the great thing about the Cliffs of Moher...
Did you do that just for this show or had you gone anywhere?
I went down there, yeah. Quickly. And you can do it in so many ways as well because, you see, I remember doing a bus tour from Galway and we got down there and, of course, they were completely... It was fog and I couldn't see them. So I was literally standing on the Cliffs of Moher and couldn't see them. So that was quite frustrating. But you can obviously go, you know, overland. And then there's the boat trip from Doolin and I know you're fond of the Aran Islands and you go to Inishere and you get to see them.
It's supposed to be beautiful.
Well.
View back, isn't it?
Yeah, it's stunning, yeah. And then here's another segue to movies because I learned on that trip.
Come.
Yeah, there you go. There was a Harry Potter movie filmed using the Cliffs of Moher. Now, I stood there staring at the Cliffs of Moher thinking, I cannot picture what scene it was, but I'm not too sure which movie it was. But so it also shows the importance of destination tourism in terms of, you know, films and movies and why people come here. That's it. And so it was part of that as well. So, you know, and then, of course, it has such a huge impact in the area as well because obviously there's very little you can do with the Cliffs of Moher, but obviously it's the boat trips, the tours, the buses, the you know, it's so it's such a huge significant part of the region as well. And then in third is north of the border is Titanic in Belfast. Kind of surprised by this in some respects because for me it's one that you go, you visit once and you don't go again.
And is that because of the movie, not to criticize it?
Perfectly.
100%,
probably the movie made it the international thing, but I just think the Titanic has always had this mystery about it and has had an interest. I mean, when I was teaching English in Japan a long time ago, but I was teaching it in there, the English language book for the foreign students featured a story on the Titanic and it was an Americanized story. So like this is just known the world over. It's an interesting exhibit and again, it doesn't seem to have the variety, say for instance, that the Guinness Storehouse can have to get you to go back a second time. Yeah. But it's very popular and hugely significant for the local economy there since it opened. These figures are maybe a couple of years out of date, but it was estimated it contributed £430 million sterling of direct spending in Northern Ireland since it opened. And then it also welcomed 6.5 million visitors up to the period from 145 different countries since it opened.
Those figures are amazing and bringing people to Belfast, which had its own kind of destination issues, you know.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the Game of Thrones tours that are there, you know, cinema, TV drives people
line
towards
Line of Duty as well.
Line of
that's
Duty.
Right. That's right, actually,
so I know a lot of people who went up to do that.
But that whole Titanic quarter there, now, I was up there recently. I don't know if it's in the top 10. There's a brilliant, I think it's a kids' science museum, but seems like an adult one to me, but that's
well, maybe
says more about me. W1A 1A is it 1A or W1A? But it's all in that Titanic Quarter, which is like the streets are hoovered. Mm-hmm. You drive in, like you're in the centre of Belfast, and you, there's millions of parking spaces. It's gorgeous up
and
there.
It's a place to go on St. Patrick's Day as well, because when I was living there in 1997, it was one of the first times that Patrick's Day was a holiday in Northern Ireland, and they started having the parade in the centre of Belfast and all the rest. So it is now a Patrick's Day's, you know, destination.
And sorry, the thing I was going to say about Belfast is the people in Belfast are incredibly friendly.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I've yet to hear a bad experience of somebody who's been there.
We went up there a few years ago for like a little mini break type thing. And not only are the people lovely, there's great food and coffee up there.
Yeah.
Like it feels like it's such a trendy city. It could be any city like in this part of the world at all. Like up there with your Barcelonas or whatever, there's just so much to do. There's an awful lot of history. And as I said, great food and coffee, which would be important to me.
So we're going to move away from the list for a second now. I'm just going to go quick flick around to get suggestions for people. What's your favourite attraction destination for people to go to today or over the weekend?
Oh, do you know where I absolutely love is Lough Key.
Forest Park.
Lovely.
Lovely. Yeah, very good.
And I would highly recommend it.
John?
My favourite place in Ireland, as Eamon's alluded to, is the Aran Islands. I just adore it. I have a family connection there. I proposed on Dún Aengus. That's my happy place. So I love the Aran Islands.
And you're quite a fan of the zoo as a place to visit, aren't you?
Yes, to an extent I am. That probably has more to do with my children. It's such a lovely day out for kids. I think it's the space. When I was a kid, they had, and it's not today or yesterday, as we've alluded to already, there was polar bears that were walking up and down and had... something had happened to them because of their captivity. The Dublin Zoo now, compared to what it was 30 years ago, it's world class as an environment. So it is a great place to visit, yeah.
And Eamon, for you?
A place, I would say north of the border, and that would be the County Antrim coast. And that would be around, because there's two places that make the top 10, which is the Giant's Causeway and Dunluce Castle. It's just a spectacular coastline. It's still relatively unspoiled, because even though mass tourism has reached there, it's also got the Carrickaread Rope Bridge, which I only learned about from a Guinness ad many years ago. You know, the rope bridge, of course.
Back to Guinness.
Yes, back to Guinness. And then a lovely village called Ballintoy on the coast. It's stunning. And it actually featured in two scenes. I only know that because the second time I went there, in Game of Thrones. So it just kind of all ties in. But look, in terms of scenery, and there are places you see Scotland from the coast as well. And you can go across to Rathlin Island. Have I got the right island there? I always get my islands mixed up. But the one there in the north coast of Ireland there. County Antrim is stunning.
Yeah, absolutely, and often forgotten.
Andy, would you like us to ask you your favourite place to visit? Edgeworthstown, is it?
Not really. Where's my favourite place to visit? I quite like Kerry as a place to visit. I think Derrynane, that beach down in Derrynane is absolutely gorgeous. Donegal is beautiful. But yeah, look, there's so many things to see and do. You will not be without your choices. But Eamon, thanks very much for taking the time to kind of go through all of that for us today. Tátú ag éisteacht le News Talk Show, I'm Andy Johnston, agus ag teacht suas tar éis an tosa. We'll be looking at our Irish songs and artists, so stay tuned to see if one of your favourite makes the top five. Fáilte ar go News Talk Show, I'm Andy Johnston, and I'm joined here in studio by John Fardy, Jess Kelly and Eamon Torsney, and we're looking into things that might keep you entertained this bank holiday weekend, and we have an Irish slant on everything, of course. Now, Jess Kelly has been looking at the Billboard list for us when it comes to artists and songs, so let's take a quick listen to this.
Someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful.
Now, no surprise there, you two, the most successful export in terms of music from a financial perspective. Jess, you were at their concert in Vegas last year. What was it like?
Oh, I don't think I've spoken about it enough, but it was incredible. I was there on the second night of the run.
Wow.
And as a
Did you take any pictures?
A few pictures, a few videos. I haven't shared them that much. I actually got told to stop by several people. But it's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen in my life. They were the first band to play in the venue that cost $2.3 billion to build. It's the only one of its kind. And what's incredible is the speaker system is built into the actual structure itself. So when you're looking at U2 on the stage, now the run just ended last week, but when you're looking at the band on the stage, there are no speakers, no amps, no nothing obstructing your view. And the imagery and the videos that play to entertain you, as well as the band, they come all around you.
So it's immersive. It's really immersive.
Fully immersive. There's a part of the show where they were playing The Fly, and all of a sudden these numbers and digits kind of come down from the ceiling, and I felt my knees go from beneath me because it's just so trippy and utterly bananas. And I think I felt quite proud watching you two up there. You kind of forget that, you know, they're incredible at what they do. The people had travelled from all over the world, not just from America, to see them play in Las Vegas. They've sold 175 million records around the world. And I do think they are one of the things that we could be prouder of.
Mm. Yeah, oh, very much so, actually. Yeah, and I was really envious when Jess went over to Las Vegas and we didn't insist that I accompany her, for professional reasons. So I'm a U2 fan. I'm a super fan. I've seen them twice in Croke Park. I've seen them in Slane, and I've seen them in Old Lansdowne Road, and really enjoyed them. My great regret was not when I was in secondary school. They played Croke Park with the Joshua Tree Tour, and some of my classmates went and I didn't, and I was raging. But I just love them. I think they're great. It's funny, I had English friends come with me to go to Croke Park to watch them, you know, and like international people fly, destination tourism, people fly to Dublin to see them in their hometown. And I remember Bono was speaking, and people were, being very vocal in the crowd about what they thought about him speaking, you know, and in their typical Dublin fashion. And my English friends were shocked. They assumed that they would be treated with reverence in terms of, and I was like explaining, no, we come here for the music, not the preaching. But in terms of, so for them, it was a great experience to see U2 in their hometown, and I think they're marvellous, great ambassadors. They featured in a storyline in Entourage. I don't know if anybody was a fan of that series, HBO series, and one of the characters literally dons the tricolour, and they all head off to Madison Square Garden's Moriah to see U2. So that's how impactful they are in terms of that. It's a mainstream in America that they're so popular.
They were in The Simpsons as well. Do you remember the episode where they're in The Simpsons, and it was during the pop era, and they were all wearing their utterly flamboyant costumes, and it's just sensational, the impact. When you say you're Irish, like, because I travel quite a bit, after the Guinness, you too, I think that you know Bono, because Ireland is like the size of a dot.
And it's interesting what you say, Jess, that you know, we should be kinder to them, because they are always pushing boundaries, not just musically, but like the Sphere is just so iconic, new. It's good, not going to be, they're always going to be the first who did that. But even in terms of their tours, John, you know, visually, how they've made things look, they're incredible, aren't they?
I'm completely in the camp they don't get the respect they deserve. If they were from any other country, we'd be calling them the greatest thing since, I don't know, the Beatles or The Who or whatever. They're unbelievable.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, I don't know. That's another conversation. Begrudgery and Irishisms and all that. I mean, maybe sometimes the Bonoisms, but, you know, I think that's always an argument ad hominem about Bono, right? Like, he's pointing at the moon and people are saying he's dirty fingernails. Yes, there is an hypocrisy that he'll admit to, that a millionaire, possibly a billionaire, is helping to make money but it's better that he do that than not do it. There's a greater good in the world by him getting billions written off South or African debt than him not doing. You know, so I'm a big fan of all he does.
The philanthropy work that they do is really important to acknowledge.
Well, that's true.
I remember being in secondary school and wearing one of the One bands. And, you know, when the iPhone came out in the red colour for the red organisation, you do end up paying attention and reading more into these causes. And if even one person donates a euro, a dollar, a pound, that makes a difference. So I do think, look, begrudgery and whatever, but you have to tip the cat to them.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Right, okay. Well, we're all big fans here and they don't get enough recognition. We get that. So who else is on the list, Jess?
There's a great mix of acts that are from today's era. So The Script, for example, wouldn't be my cup of tea, but they do feature at number 7, the late, great Sinead O'Connor. We actually spoke about Sinead on the version of the show we did around Christmas time, the impact that she had on the international stage. But then there's a name that I don't know.
Go on.
What's a Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Oh,
Eamon.
Matrimony?
Yes,
am I
that's
right?
Him. Yeah,
that's him, yeah.
Have you really not heard of Gilbert O'Sullivan?
I had to do a Google and I'm still none the wiser.
He lives in a Channel Island now, I think.
Was he from Waterford?
Yeah.
I have to say, I was surprised to see him on the list. Were you, John?
Yeah, but you know, these lists are strange. And that song, Matrimony, I was at a wedding a while ago and they played it. Like, there's money to be made in those songs. And he has a few of them. None of them are coming to me apart from
that one. He had six number ones, apparently. Yeah. That's what Google told me.
Alone Again, that's another one of his. That is a nice song.
Yeah.
So had you never heard of him?
No, and I'm kind of embarrassed.
Well, I don't know whether that's a plus or a minus, really, to be honest with you, but you hadn't. But who else is on the list, Jess?
We have to talk about Enya and the impact of Enya, because Enya's almost like a mythical Irish figure.
What is it about her? She came along and she had this new kind of mystical music and then everybody loved it except us. What happened?
I don't know. I actually don't mind Enya. My boyfriend will sometimes put it on and just have it walking around when he's cleaning around the apartment and stuff like that. And I'd be looking at him going, what are you at and why? But it's actually quite relaxing. It reminds me of, and this is no disrespect to Enya because I'm sure you're listening, on hold music.
Oh yeah.
Elevator. Isn't that what they call it? Elevator music, isn't
it? And where is she in the list?
So she is actually number six in the list. And Orinoco Flow, which is the one that we all know, Only Time, are the biggest hits in terms of the charts. But she also had other ones that kind of went under the radar. So, for example, she had another song that sampled the Fugees' Red Deer or Not. That went to number two in the charts. But she's never really engaged with the media at all.
No.
And that she's the reason why I learned the word reclusive.
Yeah.
I didn't know that word until whatever age I was when I heard that she was a bit of...
And isn't she one of the family from Planet?
It's the same family. But you see, to me, and this is interesting on a business show, it points to there is a whole hidden world of musical tastes out there that is a billion-dollar rating generator. Like AC/DC, for instance, right? Like, they're huge again, right? Mm. But there was a whole period, supposedly, in the 80s and 90s where people weren't listening to them. And then they organised a tour and they sold it. I often mention Billy Joel, right? But I remember...
You've almost made it
I was going to bring in Westlife's version of Uptown Girl, but that might set him over the edge.
No, but I'm just... there's an instructive point in this. So he, up until recently, hadn't released a song in 30 years, right? And is never in the charts, never really on the radio. And I saw him in Wembley back in like 2014. And he... Now this is... At that stage, he hadn't released a new album in like 27 years. He walked out on stage and he said, oh my God, there's 83,000 people here and we've sold out. And why is that? And it's kind of a bit like the Enya thing. There's a whole slew of music out there that is to people's taste and they quietly listen to it and download it and used to buy the CDs just because they're not on social media or they're not making like good music or music that's liked. Yeah. It goes on and has a life that we may not be aware of.
We can scoff at stuff we don't like, but it doesn't mean that it's not financially successful and popular.
Yeah, but I also think the other thing that has been in my brain as I looked at this list were the Irish bands that I love that don't appear in any of these lists.
Mm.
We have some fantastic bands like Bell X1, Ham Sandwich, All Twins. They're still active today. Every time they play a gig, I will go out of my way to go and see them. And you'd love to see them getting the respect and the adoration and the big crowds that they deserve. But they don't make the list and you still have like The Script, for example, who were just commercially successful.
Yes.
Can't explain it. There's no formula or whatever it is. They made it and the likes of Bell X1, unfortunately, internationally haven't really.
Well, somebody who does make the list, a band that makes a list, is called The Cranberries, and of course Dolores O'Riordan, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. Let's just remind ourselves of her wonderful voice. Jess, amazing.
I love the Cranberries. They sold 40 million albums. And every time you hear Dolores' voice, like I certainly get shivers. And you know instantly, within two bars, who it is. And you can feel every emotion that she's trying or that she successfully manages to evoke within you. The prime example is when they started playing Zombie after the rugby matches. Like, people woke up as if it was only released yesterday. People were going, oh my God, this song is incredible.
And then there was a controversy about whether it was nationalistic. And of course, that wasn't the sentiment behind the song at all.
It's an anti-IRA song, if it's anything, you know. But the thing about the Cranberries, what I always loved, but even when we hear that there now, is that especially like when they came into bloom in the early 90s, people weren't singing in their own Irish accents.
Yeah.
And she just gave it pure Limerick. And I mean that as an utter compliment. Like, she wasn't trying to be anything else. And I don't want to bring us all down, but like, God knows what her late blooming career could have been.
Mm.
Like, what the life that was in that voice, you know. But I'm glad she's in the top 10, or the band, sorry, 100%. The Cranberries are in the top 10. Is Van Morrison in it?
Van Morrison is in the list. He's number 4.
Of course he's in it. Yeah. So like, Van Morrison would be my favourite, and that won't be a surprise to anybody who knows me. And I've gone to all of his concerts, and he's not a good person to perform, because he doesn't engage with the audience at all. A bit like your favourite Bob Dylan. He doesn't kind of do the whole welcome to Dublin and, you know, hope you're... But he is amazing. And I think sometimes internationally, you know, he's recognised, but one of those people who at home, I just don't think properly gets the credit for how influential he has been in a music sense for so many artists who came after
him. And from like David Gray to Bruce Spring, like, they go on, they talk about Astro Weeks and even albums from the 80s, Poetic Champions Compose and all those kind of things. The problem is, though, and you know this better than I do as a fan, not just his live shows, but interviews. For instance, I have a friend who met him in a bookshop in Bath years ago, and he politely told him where to go when he said, "Hi Van, I'm a big fan." So that hasn't helped.
No, and there's a song on, I think it's on Avalon Sunset, the album, which says, you know, it's called "Why Must I Always Explain." Yes. He just doesn't want to. And we're in a different sort of society where you've got to do that thing, and he doesn't want to do it. So that's fair enough. But look, before we finish up, let's do our favourites. You've heard mine, Jess. Who's your favourite Irish artist?
I would say Ham Sandwich. They never let you down on a live gig. Seeing them at Electric Picnic is always a highlight of my year. So I'm going to say Ham Sandwich.
We haven't mentioned the Pogues and Shane McGowan and the year that's in it. John, who's your favourite?
I'd have to say you too.
Like, right.
If it was a desert island and you could only take one Irish album, it would be Achtung Baby, you know?
Okay, well, look.
Sorry, Mandy, do we have to ask yours?
I'm going to stick with Van Morrison. Okay. Thanks.
Which is your favourite Van Morrison album, incidentally?
My favourite probably is Astro Weeks,
Yeah.
The live version in particular.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you, sorry, I'll let you go.
Thank you for interviewing me on my own show. Brilliant.
You saw the most recent, because I know my wife was there, but you saw the most recent one in the Olympia.
Yeah.
That annoyed a lot of people.
Well, because he played his new album, which is entirely skiffle. So if you went along to hear Brown Eyed Girl, you'd have been very disappointed. But listen, folks, I've really enjoyed it today, and thank you so much for taking the time to come in and take us through those things that might entertain people over this weekend. And that's it for this episode, the special episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder why we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings. We're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. We'll be back next week with our usual mix of global business and politics, but we hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, ever present John Fardy, and Hugo De Silva. Scott was on sound. Anton is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers. From Taking Stock though, with me, Andy Johnston, thanks for tuning in. We'll play out with the classic The Isle of Inisfree, and all that's left for me to say is Lá Féile Pádraic, Son of Díobh Gáilear, Slán agus Beannacht.
I've met some folks who say that I'm a dreamer, and I've no doubt there's truth in what they say. But sure, a body's bound to be a dreamer when all the things he loves are far away, and precious things are dreams unto an exile. They take him o'er the land, across the sea, especially when it happens he's an exile from that dear lovely Isle of Innisfree. And when the moonlight peeps across the rooftops of this great city, wondrous though it be, I scarcely feel its wonder or its laughter. I'm once again back home in Innisfree. I wander o'er green hills through dreamy valleys and find a peace no other land could know. I hear the birds make music fit for angels and watch the rivers laughing as they flow. But dreams don't last, though dreams are not forgotten, and soon I'm back to stern reality. But though they pave the footways here with gold dust, I still would choose the Isle of Innisfree.